Welcome to The Other Side of the Plate, brought to you by Feast, families empowered and supporting treatment of eating disorders. This podcast is for moms, dads, and caregivers searching for answers, the kind that can feel so hard to find when your loved one has an eating disorder. I'm Jenny, and along with my co-host Laura, we're here as caregivers with lived experience who supported our loved ones through an eating disorder. Together, we'll share personal insights, connect you with professionals, and point you toward helpful resources. And as we say at Feast, we're here because we've been there. The content contained in this podcast is not a substitute for professional or medical treatment, and it may not represent the views and beliefs of Feast. Always consult a medical professional for medical advice and treatment recommendations. Hi, and welcome back to the Other Side of the Plate podcast. I'm Jenny Gaines, one of your co-hosts, and I'm joined by a special guest today who is talking to us from the UK. Hannah Hickenbotham is the founder of Full of Beans, an eating disorder awareness podcast all about reducing stigma and amplifying lived experience. Through inspiring conversations with people with lived experience of an eating disorder, alongside clinicians and researchers, Hannah creates a space where listeners can feel understood, validated, and a little less alone. Hannah has lived experience of atypical anorexia, body dysmorphia, and ADHD, and found her path to recovery after finally receiving an ADHD diagnosis 14 years later. Passionate about widening the conversation beyond stereotypes, she reminds people that recovery is possible, even when it doesn't look how you expected. Welcome, Hannah. Thank you so much for being here on the Other Side of the Plate podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's honestly such a pleasure. And I always really enjoy being on the other side. It feels very odd to not be asking the questions, but it is nice to be, on the other side, I guess, as well.
Well, we're so glad you're here with us today. And when I read the description of your podcast, it really resonated with me because so much of what you do feels similar to what Feast does. You really create community with the work you do. And Feast's community of caregivers was so helpful to me when my daughter was recovering. And also, I just love how much you emphasize lived experience in your work. It's so important, and I'm hoping by talking to you today that caregivers who are listening will gain some insight into how they can help their loved ones as they continue on this journey. We have so much to talk about, but I'd love to start just by giving our listeners a sense of who you are and what matters to you. And something that I've been really curious about since I learned about you is the name of your podcast. Would you be willing to share what the meaning is behind your podcast name, Full of Beans?
Sure. So in all honesty, as I now realize from my ADHD diagnosis, sometimes I do things and I think about them and I overthink until the cows come home and then things never happen. And some things I just go with. And so I'm going to be completely honest. The name was something that didn't give much consideration to, although it does have meaning behind it as I reflected on it later on. And for me, when I first started the podcast, I basically started it because I'd done a master's in eating disorders. I was very passionate and I wanted to go into research, and I basically thought, how can I stand out from the crowd? How you know, in this world where getting like an assistant psychology job is super difficult, I needed something. And one of my friends turned to me one day and said, well, you're great at chatting, so why don't you just start a podcast? And this was before podcasts were like, you know, everybody seems to have a podcast nowadays. So it was a really exciting thing to do. But I'm a very energetic person, lots of high energy. And it's interesting, actually, when I speak to people in America, because the phrase full of beans in British means like really high energy, like bouncing off the walls, lots of character. But in America, apparently that's not a thing. So that's kind of where full of beans came from, was almost like the energy levels that I have. But then as I thought about it more, it was kind of thinking about the nourishment that you give to your body. And, you know, in my recovery, beans were something that they are very diverse. They're very good for you. And, you know, they really assisted my recovery, especially at university when I was eating loads of baked beans. Again, I don't know if that's something you have in America, but like Heinz.
We do have beans.
Okay, good, good. I think a few years ago, like maybe 10, 15 years ago, baked beans weren't a thing in America. So it's like, I always have to check. People know what I'm talking about. But then also there's this phrase, and this may be a phrase in America, I'm not sure. I know in English, we love our like idioms and stuff, but like opening a can of worms is also a term for like, you know, you're opening up a big conversation that could go on quite a lot. And so for me, like opening a can of beans was kind of a synonym for that as well. So realistically, it came from, I just really liked the sound of it and it matched my personality. And then as time went on and more people were like, why'd you call it full of beans? I was like, oh, I actually need an answer for this now.
Well, that was a great answer because it was kind of something that just felt good to you. And then it started to have the meaning behind it. So it was probably an instinct. And you're right, in America, in the US, full of beans kind of means full of nonsense, or at least that was my first you know, idea when I saw your podcast name. So I was so curious. Thanks for explaining that. Being full of energy and also just the literal meaning of beans and nutrition and nourishment, that all makes sense. So that was a really fun way to start. Now we'll go into some other areas. As a caregiver myself, as a mom of someone with an eating disorder, I got a lot of professional guidance. And also I turned to caregivers who had gone before me and knew more than I knew when my daughter was first diagnosed. But I was wondering, we can learn so much from the lived experience of those who are recovered, and we don't always connect with that. Just before we get started and get into your story, what can parents and caregivers learn from your perspective as someone who's recovered compared to what they may often hear from treatment providers?
I think the biggest thing is kind of what I said in my introduction in terms of recovery. I think often clinically we have this idea of what recovery can look like. And yes, that may be some people's reality, but I think for me, part of the treatment process and the recovery journey was understanding what I actually wanted recovery to look like, not just what clinically the diagnostics would say, or you know, what my weight would be and things like that, or the foods I would be comfortable eating. It was more thinking about what I wanted out of life, what I wanted from my recovery. And I think by understanding that, that gave me so much more motivation, because all of the things that were clinically being asked of me were terrifying. You know, you need to be able to eat this. You've got to eat this amount of calories per day. You've got to not exercise. You've got to get to this certain weight. But once I started to think about it tangibly in terms of, I want to be able to go traveling. Like I want to, you know, I think often we also go for big things. But for me, this weekend was a fantastic example. One of my friends is training to be a chef. Before, there's no way I would have been able to sit down and eat her food, because it was just, I had no idea what was in it. Somebody else had prepared it for me. I couldn't plan. But this weekend, I had dinner at hers. She cooked me brunch the next day. We went to a yoga class. And these were all things I couldn't do, because for me, yoga felt like, well, it's too slow. Like I have to be doing intense exercise. So I think even just breaking it down to the tiny day-to-day things, like I want to be able to sit and have a conversation with my friends without my brain being filled with calories. By doing that, that really helped me to actually think, this is something I do want. And it's not terrifying. It's really nice. So hopefully that's, I guess, the biggest perspective I can bring, is that recovery looks completely different for every person and there's no right and wrong. And also you may have this idea when you're in recovery of, this is the thing I would like it to look like. And it will probably be completely different. But I think being open-minded, which is very difficult, I think when you live with like a restrictive eating disorder and that rigidity, that can be really helpful for your recovery.
That's so helpful to hear, that it's really your personal recovery. Mm. And I can only imagine what that feels like to have everyone else telling you, this is what recovery is. So hearing that is really refreshing, and having some distance between when my daughter was really ill and now, I can see that it didn't happen as a destination. It's an ongoing journey. And within that, it is going to be so personalized to the individual. And I think that can be kind of scary as a mom to not know what it's going to look like, but also reassuring to know that there's a path in there. A path to that recovery. So thank you so much. Every person's journey is different, as what you and I have both already said. And Just to give the listeners an idea about what your journey has been like, would you be willing to share a little bit about your story?
Yeah, absolutely. So before I say anything about my journey, one thing I'm always really conscious of is that I've had, well, now probably 15 years of therapy. So when I share my story or speak, it often sounds very figured out. You know, it's kind of like a clear direction, a clear path. And I always like to say when I was experiencing it, it was not as clear as this. And this is kind of, you know, the work that I've done over the past 15 years is what's led me to have this clarity and this understanding. Because I think when I used to listen to things and people would share their eating disorder experience, I'd be like, well, I'm never going to recover because they've got it all figured out. And do I need to have it all figured out at this point to be able to recover? So I just like to say that beforehand so that people don't worry. And equally, I think when I do talk about my experience, it's all kind of things that I assume based on what I know now about eating disorders that could have been potential triggers. But as we know, eating disorders, you know, they can be caused by absolutely anything. And I think that's what's so difficult often about recovery is you kind of want to know what's caused it. And actually, for me, it's been about, okay, I can't necessarily know what the specific triggers were for this, but kind of what can I do now with my emotions and my feelings looking forwards to support myself? But in general, I had a fantastic childhood. There was so much love and so much warmth and, you know, a very protected household, which I'm very lucky to have had. I think, you know, not uncommon to other families, there was diet culture. There was dieting, there was lots of comments about weight and shape and different things like that. And I think I definitely, my self-worth became about how I looked and how I sort of presented myself in a way. And I remember, it's funny now as an adult reflecting back on situations because they happened as a child that I just thought were normal. But then I'll tell my mum about them and she kind of like, kind of that, why did you never say anything? Why didn't you say that out loud? And one specific memory I have is I have weird shaped toenails. It's just a genetic thing. But I thought that that was because I was fat. And so I remember for a couple of years in PE class, which is like phys ed in America, I would compare my toenails to the other children, and I would specifically look at other children that were slim to be like, you know, do their toenails look like mine? Now they didn't because of the genetic thing. You know, I say weird toenails is kind of, you know, it's not massively weird, just a different shape. But I said that to my mum a few weeks ago, and she was like, "You must. That's just an example of how much you must have internalized that you were different to everybody else and that you were kind of trying to look for validating signs or what have you." And I think that very much, you know, that was present since I was 3-4 years old. I remember being in nursery and comparing myself to other children. And I now know because of my neurodiversity. I obviously mentioned in the introduction that I've got ADHD. I'm also in the process of being diagnosed with autism. And so I think maybe what happened is that sort of feeling different because my brain felt different, I couldn't really put, like, you know, that wasn't something that I could clearly speak about. But because I obviously felt that I was overweight, that must therefore be the thing that was different about me. But I was always a very happy child. I always, you know, I never struggled to make friends. And my dad laughs now because he thinks that my like hyperfocus or that the thing that I enjoy the most is making friends, which is a lovely thing to do. But I think equally in that respect, now that I know about the neurodiversity, I always felt like I was very excited to make friends, but then all of a sudden I'd get this sheer panic and be like, oh my God, no, like I'm too fat to be their friend, or I'm larger than everybody else and I won't fit in this group. And so I think that's why when I was about 13, 14, and my mum had continuously been on a diet, and she'd continuously been on a diet from a child because her mum had always been on a diet. And I don't blame anybody in that sense. You know, I think that's unfortunately the society that we live in. But it just made sense to me age 13, 14. Well, obviously I'm going to go on a diet. That's what my mum's done. It's what my sister's done. That's what my aunt's done. That's what my grandma's done. And I did. And I think at the time, my mum was very much just trying to encourage me to eat healthily. But because of my all or nothing mindset, that was when it just became food was a number. And, you know, I think I now recognize a pattern of myself, and I do it, you know, day to day in my business. If I achieve a certain thing, so let's say I achieved a certain calorie target, I know that I can achieve that now. So then I would push myself lower and lower and lower. And it that just became sort of like a self-perpetuating cycle of everything just became about numbers, and there was nothing nourishing or enjoyable about food. It was literally just, how can I eat as little as this as possible? Mm-hmm. And I mean, I could go on and on about the journey that I had, but ultimately I had I went to the doctors 3 times over the course of 10 years, each time being met with a diagnosis of atypical anorexia, which, if people haven't heard of that, basically it's when you meet all the criteria for anorexia, but your BMI isn't less than 18.5. And for a disease that is characterized by perfectionism, by rigidity, by people pleasing, being told that you're not quite there was heartbreaking. And so that's why on each 3 times that I went to the doctor, on the first time I did try and kind of go through treatment. But I remember one day my parents were renovating the house at the time, and my mum was like, we're just quite worried because we only have access to a microwave, so we're not really able to cook that much. And the doctor just turned around and said, we'll just order a pizza. I was almost like, she can't currently eat an apple. How do you think that she's going to eat a pizza? And I think it was just comments like that that just made me feel so invalidated and misunderstood. And I think now, again, having an awareness of neurodiversity, that was a common place for me of just feeling too much, not enough, you know, like everyone was judging me, everybody was different to me, everybody was better than me. And so I think that's kind of why I got caught in a cycle of getting a little bit better on my own, and then something would happen and the eating disorder was just, it was just the answer. And I think, you know, it might sound controversial to say, but ultimately what I now realize as well is when you have ADHD and autism, something I personally find very difficult is regulating my emotions. And anorexia really is quite a good way to regulate your emotions, because you don't feel any. And that is not me advising anybody to do that. I think it's, you know, it's genuinely one of the worst coping mechanisms in the world. However, I can see why people get caught up in it, because if you don't have another way to regulate your emotions, it feels like the only answer. And so I think that's why for 14 years, I just kept getting caught in a loop of the eating disorder felt like the only thing. And as soon as I started to try and recover, it was as though someone was taking that safety blanket off me. Everything was being ripped away from me, because the one thing I had, I no longer had. And I did start to recover quite well. I say quite well, I guess I was being less restrictive, but exercise had started to become something that was it was unnegotiable for me. I had to do it every day to a certain point. And I think that, especially in our modern society, it was quite easy to say, no, I'm eating completely fine now because I'm a gym bunny. So I have to have X amount of protein. I have to eat at certain times of the day, and I can't possibly have that food that you've made for me because I have to make sure I'm hitting my macronutrients. And so it was a very easy way to hide the disordered eating, but everybody thought that was okay because I looked okay. And I think that was, I think it's really interesting because an eating disorder, you know, it's not classified as an addiction, but in my own studies and the work that I do think there's quite a lot of commonalities between eating disorders and addiction. And I think my eating disorder kind of just merged into an exercise addiction with some disordered eating on the side. And I think people often don't realize that you have to be very careful when you're in recovery to not basically develop another addiction. And, you know, from speaking to colleagues that work in addiction, they will often say, when you first come into rehab, you're not allowed to exercise because that could become your next addiction. And it's seen as a healthy addiction. So I think that was definitely a challenge. And then obviously we had the global pandemic, which no access to the gym there. And also no access to your community, no access to friends, no access to any outlets. And that's when I had a really significant relapse. And it started with not so much the eating disorder symptoms. It was more like depression and suicidality. I had to take some time off work because of the kind of like severe depression. And I really got to a point where I just couldn't be alone on my own. So in one way, the pandemic felt great for that because my partner was at home all the time. So I was never alone. But on the other hand, it obviously kind of built very, like a lot of reliance on him. And because I couldn't access the gym, I just ended up working out all the time at home, and doing like online workouts or working out in the garden and things like that. And I think because I didn't see my parents for such a long time, I slipped very quickly. And it wasn't then until we started coming out of lockdown that it was like, oh God, like this is really hit quite badly. But I think I always find it really interesting when I think about my journey, because I remember saying like, I'll never go back there. Like, it's such a horrible place. I'll never go back. And I did go back. But I think the reason I went back is because of what I said about not knowing how to regulate my emotions. And then when I actually started therapy with the therapist that I worked with, who was the one that diagnosed me with or mentioned ADHD, she showed me this wheel of emotions. And it's kind of like core six emotions in the middle, and then there's loads of emotions off it. And I was just like, sorry, how does one person feel all of this? I thought that there was kind of euphoria, so like intense happiness and then intense depression. And I just flicked between the two of them. And if I ended up in the middle, that to me was just boredom. So I kind of had to push myself into that euphoria or push myself into that depression. But the fact that there was like, you know, all of these emotions at the start was very overwhelming. But I think the biggest piece of recovery for me was learning about those emotions, how to vocalize the emotion, how to understand the emotion, and then kind of understand my needs in relation to that emotion as well. So if I'm feeling bored, what can I do? You know, maybe I do sit in that boredom, or is there something I can do to distract myself? You know, if I'm feeling happy, if I'm feeling sad, if I'm feeling excited, if I'm feeling annoyed, like angry was one that I could not feel at all. It just made me so upset to feel angry. But now that I've kind of got a hold on what those emotions mean, how to kind of soothe myself or what I need in that moment, it's meant that I don't really need to rely on food anymore to suppress it or to navigate it. And I feel like that just minimizes the whole story so much to say, I understood my emotions, so I no longer needed food. But I guess in a summary of the past 15 years, I think that's kind of what my journey has been. And it's been a journey to accepting myself, accepting kind of the crazy chaos, but also accepting that deep desire to be alone and to just kind of be just with myself. And for somebody who loves seeing their friends so much, kind of that can be so difficult. And I think that having self-compassion and understanding what I need, that's genuinely been the biggest thing, because I no longer feel like I need to kind of hurt myself or punish myself because of how I'm feeling.
Oh, thank you, Hannah, for sharing all of that. So many great things that we could go into there, but just hearing you talk about it and the fact that you have had so much therapy and you have been able to experience this process of kind of figuring yourself out when maybe no one else even understood what was going on for you. Mm-hmm. There's so many parallels, at least for my one person case study, my daughter. Emotional regulation was a big part of her recovery also. And as a caregiver, I think one of the most valuable things I learned is that not all of us are wired the same way. Like, just because I might react to a certain situation a certain way, that doesn't mean that my kids or my husband are wired that way. And so I think learning to kind of co-regulate our emotions was really helpful for me. And also, when you were talking, something that really stood out to me is that when you were first experiencing your eating disorder, you didn't have the benefit of knowing that you had ADHD yet. You're just now exploring the autism piece. It sounds like body dysmorphia was predating the eating disorder based on what you have said. And I think that can be a part where caregivers get really hung up. I know for me, I knew my daughter had an OCD diagnosis. I can look back now and see that she had body dysmorphia at a very young age, but I wasn't able to pinpoint it because, like you, she internalized some of it. So I'm sure that she had some things, just like with your toenails, that she was attributing to something that maybe didn't quite line up in her young age. And so the question that formed for me while you were talking was, do you have any insight into how we should present as parents to the initial providers? We know that there's a problem. I knew my daughter had anorexia because she lost an extreme amount of weight in a short period of time when I wasn't around. She was away. But that was just the beginning. The anorexia diagnosis was just the beginning. And it was so overwhelming to try to figure out what the next steps are. And it's hard to be that confident parental voice when you don't understand eating disorders and you are so worried about your child and you're willing to take any action needed to help her or him. And you just want the like three steps. Just tell me, you know, what should I do? What are the next three steps? I'm just wondering from your personal experience, when it's that much coming at you at once, if, you know, if you could look back and think, I wish, you know, my parents had done this or that. It sounds like your parents are wonderful. I know I've considered myself a really good mom, but maybe I didn't do all the things. I'm just curious from your perspective, if there's anything you can offer to caregivers who are trying to figure out kind of that messiness.
Yeah. Do you know, I think this is one of the hardest parts, and I would love to have a list and say, right, if your child, if your loved one has got an eating disorder, this is what you need to do. Unfortunately, the reason eating disorders are so tricky and so complex is because every single person is so unique and so individual. I think the biggest thing I would say is, and this, I think this is for mums and for dads, but in my experience, I would particularly, I'm gonna say from my mum's perspective, and then I'll say from my dad's perspective. I think from my mum's perspective, the most important thing she had to do was to realize that she couldn't fix me. No matter what she tried, she wasn't always going to be able to understand what was going on. She wasn't going to be able to just, you know, wrap me up in cotton wool. My mum very much, from when I was born, wanted to be able to wrap me up in cotton wool and do everything to protect me. And whilst that is the most wonderful thing, and I'm so grateful for that, unfortunately, that's not reality. And in light of that, I guess I kind of needed to learn how to look after myself and deal with my own stuff. And I'm not saying that that means that, you know, parents and carers can't be there for people, but I think from my experience, when my recovery started was, and this sounds very bougie, you definitely don't need to do this in order to recover. However, I went to Indonesia for 2 weeks, and the places where we were staying, there were no places to make your own food. That, you know, there was no self-catered accommodation. There was also nowhere for me to exercise. So normally if I'd go on holiday, there would be a space where I would be able to do a workout. And on this holiday, there wasn't that. So I had 2 weeks of no exercise other than exploring around and being fed every single meal and not being able to prepare that for myself. And I remember sitting on the plane journey home and I thought, I never thought I'd be able to do this. And I'd done it. I mean, it had been horrific, don't get me wrong. The holiday was wonderful, but it had been really, really tough. But I thought, maybe this is a moment that I have to think, I either carry on this trajectory because things maybe are going in a recovery direction, or I just go back to where I was, knowing full well that my relationship was falling apart. I was losing friends. My family were in complete despair. But I had to be the one to make that decision. And I think you can help somebody as much as possible to see the reasons why recovery will be beneficial for them, or to kind of help guide them in that way. But ultimately, I think, and this is kind of to clinicians as well, the person that is in need and sort of needs to be the one to make the decision that they want to recover. I think as parents and as carers and as clinicians, we can hold on to hope that recovery is possible. And we can kind of, you know, say to people, I still believe in you. And like, I know you can do this. But we can't be the ones to fix. And I think for my mum, that was one of the most important things to realize was she couldn't fix me. I needed to do that myself. But also, and, you know, I think that's why places like organizations like Feast are so great, was to find support for herself. Because supporting someone with an eating disorder is really, really difficult, but it does impact every aspect of your life. And I think that if you're supporting somebody, it then becomes the center of your life as well. And I think it impacts, you know, I remember my mum would say, like, oh, you know, I went out with my friends, but all they asked about was you. And I obviously felt awful because I wanted her to go and have time and to kind of offload and, you know, have fun herself. But I think being able to find those spaces to get support and to talk to people that understand, but also to talk about things completely different as well, because it is a very difficult thing to go through. And then I think on the other side, and this will probably be my second piece of advice, whilst I've said you're never going to be able to understand, and, you know, not you're never going to be able to understand, but like you're never going to fully understand someone's perspective or how they're feeling. The thing that my dad did was, I mean, he just went away and he researched for hours on end each night to try and understand what the hell is an eating disorder, what is my daughter going through, what can I do to help her. And I don't think you need to go and get a degree in eating disorders, but I think what can be useful is to understand what could be going on for somebody or why an eating disorder could occur, and then almost open up that conversation with your loved one if when it's an appropriate moment. I mean, probably not at a meal time when an argument could occur, but, you know, if you're going for a walk or something and, you know, you just want to ask them some questions about what's going on, I think having that open communication, an eating disorder just becomes the elephant in the room where everyone knows it's there, but no one's talking about it. And so I think if you can do it in an environment that feels safe for everybody and it is away from food to ask, like, you know, what's going on at the moment? How are you feeling? You know, could you tell me a bit more about what's going on for you right now? I really want to be there to help you. And you know, to do that, it's important for me to understand more. I think kind of approaching it in that way, rather than saying you have an eating disorder, an eating disorder is this, like I've done my reading. It's using that knowledge that you find to then kind of have more awareness in the conversation, but not making those assumptions.
Thank you so much. I think that is feeling really important to me, the actually talking about it instead of walking on eggshells around the elephant in the room. It was really hard to know how I could do that without the distress reaction, because so much of my emphasis was on let's get you to eat enough. And so it was hard sometimes to see my daughter and not only see the eating disorder. So hearing you say that, you know, with your mom or your dad to just be able to go on a walk and to ask you questions about what you're experiencing, what it's like for you, and asking, how can I support you? That's something that when you're in the context of three meals and three snacks a day and you have to get to this weight goal and you cannot do compulsive exercise and I have to make sure you're safe 24 hours a day, I think that piece gets lost. And I think had I been doing that and I knew how to do it, I would have felt so much better during that part of her recovery process. So thank you so much for sharing that. And you were also talking a little bit about the resistance to recovery. For me as a mom, one of the most discouraging parts was even as she was physically doing better, my daughter was still struggling emotionally, psychologically. And it can get really discouraging when you see you're feeling kind of hopeful because you know physically there's progress, but at the same time, you're seeing that your loved one isn't motivated to get better. They maybe haven't identified those things that you talked about in the beginning, the things that, you know, made your life really interesting and fun and you looked forward to doing. Is there any insight you could offer caregivers and parents when their loved ones experiencing that resistance and maybe hasn't found their motivation to recover, or maybe the eating disorder isn't allowing them to have that motivation to recover?
I think you've just absolutely knocked the nail on the head there. And that was something I was going to say, I think is so important, is the I can't talk about this experience, but I can talk about it kind of from my parents and from my partner's experience of the sheer frustration of seeing somebody, if we're being honest about it, slowly kill themselves in front of your eyes and not seem to be making any effort to change that. I can completely understand why that is the perspective that some people have. I think the way that I try to frame it, and I don't think that even when you use words, you can kind of describe the significance of it. But if you imagined your absolute worst nightmare, that you thought if you engaged in that, then it's really difficult to say, and I'm kind of stumbling over my words, but the consequence of not following an eating disorder feels worse than death. And that's purely from my experience. I don't really know what could be worse than death, because that's very terminal, isn't it? But I think for me, the idea of gaining weight felt that significant. And so if you put it in that perspective, having to wake up every day and knowing that you needed to engage in something that was going to trigger your worst nightmare completely ever imaginable, you can understand why there's a bit of resistance to it, and you can understand why people maybe aren't jumping for glee and, you know, really excited to get engaged and to get involved. But again, I can understand from a caregiver's perspective why that is so difficult, because you want them to be better. You want them to be back to that person they used to be, or maybe like a new version of themselves. But when it's someone you love, you don't want to see them suffering. But I think that was how I always tried to describe it, or maybe now on reflection, I tried to describe it to my parents in terms of the fact of like, it was so significant that there was nothing, even like the biggest thing in the world, didn't, like a positive thing, didn't equate to the negativeness that not engaging would have. And I think it's very difficult in terms of helping people to find that motivation, because I know my mum used to say things like, well, you know, if you don't get better, then you'll never be able to have children. But in that moment of time, I didn't want that. And I don't know whether this is maybe kind of the autistic perspective, or maybe how an eating disorder kind of morphs your mind. But I very much struggle to see the future in that way. Like when people say, what are your goals for your life? Or, you know, for 2026, for example, and people are doing mood boards and stuff. I'm like, I don't know. I'm just trying to get through the here and now. I'm just trying to get through today. And then people say, oh, so you live very much in the moment. And I'm like, no, I'm very much not living in the moment. I'm very anxious and worried all the time. But I can't see how my behaviors right now are going to impact my future. And I think that's what makes recovery so difficult as well, because if you can see that, okay, eating this sandwich is going to help my recovery and it's going to help me get to those goals that I have, that kind of step-by-step process helps. But I think when you're so entrenched by fear of what would happen if you let go of the eating disorder, you can't possibly rationalize how, well, even if you can rationalize how that sandwich is going to help you get to your future, that future is not something that you want. And so I think that's the reason that motivation piece is so difficult, because there's so many blockers in the way. And even if you do want to go traveling, or you do want to have children, or you do want to be engaged with your friends, I think it's only when you start to recover that you realize how good those things are. And that was absolutely my experience. You know, I got off that plane from Indonesia and in the back of my mind thought, I think I might try this. And I did start to try it, and it was excruciating and it was awful. But as time went on, I started to see the glimmers of life that I'd been missing out on that recovery was giving me. And I remember the first time that I really felt like I was feeling quite different. And one of my friends said to me, your eyes are looking quite sparkly today. Mm-hmm. And it was nothing to do with my weight or the food that I was eating or anything. And then I think it was that same event I went to, and somebody, I mean, I guess on reflection, it was kind of a weird statement for them to make, but they were like, it's so lovely for you to be engaged today. and like engaged in the event. And I just thought, wow, I thought that I was very much coasting. No one really recognized that I had an eating disorder. Everyone, you know, they just thought I was normal Hannah. No, everybody knew how, like, there was no life behind my eyes. I'd just kind of sit there. I wouldn't engage in conversation. And that was so opposite to the Hannah that I am. But I think it was when I started to realize things like that and those little moments in the everyday that it was kind of like, ah, okay, this is what recovery is. And that's what then motivated me. So I suppose you kind of have to get some momentum going beforehand, and you have to kind of grit your teeth and feel that excruciating pain after every meal to then start to see the benefits of recovery, which is what keeps on motivating you.
Wow, that was the best explanation of the resistance and the lack of motivation to recover that I've heard. And it really helps us, I think, understand what our loved ones are going through. Like if it's your worst nightmare to do what your loved ones are asking you to do, it explains why it's so distressful. You know, distress tolerance was one of the most important tools that I learned when I was helping my daughter through this. And I don't think there's anything harder than watching your child in that much distress, but understanding why they're in that much distress, I think, would be really helpful to help show up in the calm and supportive way that you need to, instead of getting all caught up in it and kind of losing your own ability to regulate your emotions. So much of what you said, in hindsight, I wish I had known, but I'm hoping that some parents hearing this today will get a sense of what you're seeing is the eating disorder at work. It's not a defiant child. It's not a child that's trying to cause any kind of trouble for you in any way, but it's really, really that difficult that no great thing in the world was going to be good enough to overcome how bad it felt to do the things that you needed to do to recover. And so to hear you say you had to go through excruciating pain in order to see the glimmers of recovery, I mean, that lands a lot with me, because watching my daughter go through it, because we're told, you know, one thing you can do is separate your child from the eating disorder. At least I was told that, or externalize the eating disorder. But when you are watching, you know, it's your child's body that you're seeing in front of you and all of that distress. And it feels like you are doing things to hurt them. And yet, you know, you have to go through that excruciating pain. You have to have them go through that excruciating pain, which as a mom, I'm sure your mom also felt like, yeah, you said she wanted to like wrap you up and just protect you. It doesn't feel like that's what you're doing. Do you think that idea of separating your child from the eating disorder or externalizing the eating disorder is something that makes sense, or something that maybe we need to look at a little bit differently?
I think I sit on both sides. I think that it can be a very good way to like compartmentalize who is your loved one and who is the eating disorder. And I think that maybe further on in recovery, it can be very useful for the individual that's kind of, you know, in recovery. I know now, even to this day, if I'm having a bad day, I'll say, oh, the eating disorder wants me to, or like I'm feeling these really intense thoughts and I think they're coming from the eating disorder. But I think that takes quite a lot of learning and untangling to be able to understand what's me and what's the eating disorder. And I think especially when you're in the deepest part of an eating disorder, you have no idea what is you and what is the eating disorder. And I think for me, after 14 years of struggling, I mean, I was the eating disorder. I'm, you know, it, there was no kind of separation. So I think remembering that your child or that your loved one is being driven by the eating disorder, and remembering that they're not doing this because they're trying to annoy you, or they're trying to upset you or frustrate you. They are doing this because it is a disease that is driving them to engage in these compulsive behaviors, I think feels more helpful in a backwards way than trying to separate. I mean, obviously, you can try and separate, but I think there becomes so much overlap that you might get more frustrated by not being able to separate. And then maybe further down the line, you know, it is an open conversation you can have. And I think that would be a really nice reflective question as a parent or carer, if you recognize that your loved one is struggling and can see them kind of getting caught up in it or getting, you know, feeling quite overwhelmed, say, you know, can you understand where this is coming from? Like, is this coming from you, or is this coming from the eating disorder? And maybe, you know, what is it that the eating disorder needs right now? You know, how can we honor that? How can we respect the eating disorder? Because I think this is another backwards way of thinking, but I remember having this revelation in therapy of like, the eating disorder is only trying to protect me. Like, everything it's doing because it's trying to protect me, and it is trying to look after me, and it doesn't think that I can sort of navigate this on my own. And I did a bit of EMDR, and I had this really beautiful visualization where little Han, it's like me as a child, was walking down a road with big Han, and we were holding hands, and it was a kind of a signal to the eating disorder to say, we can look after each other now. We don't need you. Thank you so much for everything, because ultimately you helped us through lots of difficult situations when we didn't feel that there was another option, but we have other options now. And so I think almost giving the eating disorder that space to say, thank you, but we don't need you anymore, can be so powerful to then kind of bring in what can we do instead that's going to be helpful. And what is it that we need, I need, that the eating disorder needs? Because maybe it is just that you all need something to soothe right now, but you don't know how to self-soothe, so you just automatically turn to the eating disorder. So I think that maybe is, in my experience, been a better way. I suppose it is separating it out, but just remembering why that's occurring and why that's coming up, I think, can be really useful.
Oh, that was a beautiful description, that imagery of holding hands and thanking the eating disorder and saying goodbye to it, letting it go. I really like that. And the piece that you said about untangling, I think that's what this feels like from day one, is we're trying to untangle something that at the outset, you're not even going to be able to see where all the tangles are, I don't think. And so I think knowing that, and hearing that, and knowing you are thriving right now in your recovery is so hopeful to parents who maybe feel like, how are we ever going to untangle this? So that's a really beautiful piece. And I wanted to ask you one more thing. Our whole conversation has been a lot about caregivers trying to figure out how can we help our loved ones, and what is supportive for our loved ones. We aren't sure, and we're almost sometimes scared to try based on some of the reactions that we get. So I would love to hear, who were your most significant supporters during your treatment and recovery, and what did their support look like for you when it was helpful?
So it's my obvious ones, my parents, absolutely. And I think their support was patience and unconditional love, knowing that no matter what, they still loved me and they were there for me. And I guess that as well, just kind of being there when I needed. But I think what they lacked was supporting themselves. And I think that's a fundamental part that is often forgotten about, is, you know, the saying, you can't pour from an empty cup. I think I see so many parents and carers who are so at their wit's end with, I just don't know what to do. And as I mentioned before, like, their life has become all consumed. One thing that my partner was very good at, he categorically said, I'm never going to be a carer. And I really respected that, because he is my partner and I didn't want him to be my carer. But that meant that if we had arranged a social event and then I didn't want to go because I was scared about food or scared about socializing or I'd had a bad day, he still went. And at the time, I was like, absolute. Like, that's, how could you do that? How could you leave me like this? But he needed to look after himself in that moment. He needed to have that space to be with friends. And I needed to respect that he needed that. So I think he is a really good example of somebody who challenged me. He kind of made sure that he was looking after himself. but he was also there every step of the way. I know my partner loves going out for food, so one of his biggest roles was taking me out for dinner, which I hated at the time, I now love. But that was something that he wanted to be able to do with his girlfriend. He wanted to be able to go out for food and enjoy it and not be scared about it. So that was wonderful. I think a support that is often not talked about, that I talk about all the time, because it was so incredibly important to me, was my pets. There's so much unconditional love from pets, and I could be screaming and shouting, I could be crying my eyes out, I could be mute, I could be completely emotionally void, and they were there. I have two cats at my house that I have with my partner, and then I have a dog at home. And I just genuinely remember sitting there one day and thinking, they love me no matter what I look like, no matter what I've eaten, what have you. All they want is to sit and cuddle me and show me love. And for me, that was genuinely one of the biggest recovery motivators, was I don't want to not be able to feel connected to them and feel loved and to like embrace that and enjoy that. And I knew that in order to feel those emotions, I needed to fuel myself, because to feel any emotion, I needed fuel. And so I think I mentioned before that I really struggled during my relapse being home on my own. Having the cats at home meant that still to this day, it means I'm never at home on my own. And they are very loud little, they sing around the house all day. So it's just wonderful to have them. And I think that I've spoken to a lot of people where, particularly neurodivergent people who maybe struggle to feel kind of accepted by people or feel slightly different, animals have such a profound impact of just accepting you and just appreciating the you that you are on any day.
I love all of that. The message about self-care to all of the people who are supporting someone with an eating disorder, because it can kind of feel like you're taking your eye off the ball when you do that, but it's so, so important. The unconditional love piece, and then the pets. My daughter's cat was really important to her. I think it was really the only way at the time when she was really ill to allow herself to feel loved, to receive love and to give love, was through her little cat. I'll always be grateful to we still have that cat. I'll always be grateful to her for the role that she played in my daughter's recovery. But thank you so much for sharing that. I had another question for you that I know caregivers, parents will be eager to know about, and that's, are you willing to share how you protect your recovery now that you're where you are today?
Great question. I think this has been something that has also been a learning curve from being diagnosed with ADHD, is I'm a massive people pleaser. Like, I am the biggest yes man. And in order to protect my energy and to protect my recovery, sometimes I have to say no. And it's so horrible. I hate it. I want to please everybody and I want to do everything. But I've realized that if I'm not looking after myself, then I'm not looking after anybody. And sometimes that means saying no to friends, to social events, or to business opportunities, or have you. But I think by being really mindful, have I got the capacity to do that? Is there too much going on in life already? Like, how is that going to feel on that day? Because I very much am an overcommitter, but then I burn out incredibly quickly. But I think in the same respects that I'm learning about navigating ADHD, like that, I guess it's the same in my recovery, of just being quite protective of my space and what I welcome into my space. And if something's triggering, being able to say, actually, I don't want that. Like, I don't need that in my life. Before it would be like, I'll just suck it up and carry on. Whereas now it's very much, if it's not helpful or helping me move forward, it's not really something that I'm willing to have.
Yeah. Thanks so much for sharing that. I'm sure it's different for everyone, as we've talked about. And I'd love to continue talking to you, but I think we should probably close and maybe I can talk to you hopefully another time to get even more great wisdom and information from you. But will you speak directly to families who may be in a really hard place right now? Like if parents and caregivers are listening and feeling stuck where they are with their loved ones, is there anything that you could share to help them keep going?
I think I don't want to say anything that, like, you know, says it gets better or, you know, there's hope or stuff like that, because I know how horrific it can be when you're in that place and when you just genuinely don't think that there is a way out. But I think for me, when I was in that space, it was trying to find those little glimmers in each day. And actually, I mean, this is something that I've started doing recently, not when I was in recovery, but me and my mum now text each other every morning three things that we're grateful for. And some days they're massive things. And the other day I was in such a bad mood, I felt really low, but I went for a walk outside and it was -8 degrees here, which is very cold for Cambridge. And you know, when you smile and your cheeks are like really tight because it's so cold. And so that was one of the things I was grateful for, was going outside and smiling and my cheeks being tight. And I think that that almost can be quite a good motivator, or just something to remind you that even though it's really dark right now, there's still very small moments of happiness. And it's really nice to reflect as you then go along the process, because you start to notice those things maybe growing a bit or getting a bit more significant. But I think that's really helpful on those really dark days. Doing the gratitude stuff is more helpful on the bad days than it is on the good days, because on the bad days, you've gotten into the practice of being grateful for those little things. The bad days don't feel quite so bad because you've still got something to hold on to.
I can't think of any better advice than that, to look for the glimmers and collect them.
Yeah.
And keep moving forward. I think that's a great way for us to end our conversation. And we're going to be sure to provide links to the Full of Beans podcast and to Hannah's website, so you can find out more about the work she does. We'll put that in our show notes. And Hannah, I can't thank you enough for being here. I learned so much from listening to you and hearing your perspective and getting your insights into what it's like on your side. And I know it's different for every single individual and different for every single family, but there are parallels that are so important for us to consider, think about, and help inform the way that we're caring for our loved ones. So thank you so, so much for being here.
Amazing. Thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor.
Thank you for joining us at The Other Side of the Plate. If today's episode gave you hope or guidance, we invite you to explore more resources and peer support at feast-ed.org. Remember, you are never alone. For more conversations of hope and help for families facing eating disorders, please join us for our next episode.